Hello, I'm Hudson Foga. This is number 0163 of the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0163. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, author Raymond Benson is back. He's on to talk about his officially sanctioned James Bond novels, which are now about to come out for the Kindle. What made James Bond so popular back in the 60s?
It came about during the 1960s at the right time. The ingredients were such that it was a no-brainer that it would become an archetype. See, in the 60s, everything coming out of England was cool. You know, we had the Beatles, you had Swinging London, you had all that mod stuff, and you had James Bond.
Jeffrey Gurian is the co-author of Make 'em Laugh, 35 Years of the Comic Strip, the greatest comedy club of all time.
It's a book for comedy fans. It's a book for industry people. It's a book for the comedians themselves to read, you know, like young aspiring comics who want to read how people got their start. I was always fascinated about that because as talented as you are, there's so much luck involved.
Ford dealer Marty Giles, who made a commercial for his dealership after thieves stole tires and rims from his lot. The commercial has gone viral. Was he surprised by the attention it garnered?
Absolutely, especially because it was, we did it in June, and there was huge response around our community for about a week or 10 days. Then it kind of died over, people got used to us running it. Then about like 12 days ago, one of my sales guys came in and he saw it on some blog, and then we got a call out of Phoenix, a TV station down there that did a story on it, and then all of a sudden, we had like 4,000 YouTube hits, then it went to 12,000, and it's like now I think it's almost 60,000 YouTube hits right now on the ad, and it's not even any video, it's just a radio ad, right? So. I can't believe it. What it's done in the last 12 days is unbelievable.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0163, was Hudson Foga, a writer, translator, and former broadcaster. And you can check out his website at hudsonfoga.com. And thank you very much, Hudson, for doing the guest Slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. A program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smart way to listen to radio. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, police in Oxford, Ohio were sent to two next-door fraternity houses associated with Miami University on a report of fire alarm sounding. Now, officers say the two houses, Alpha Epsilon and Phi Kappa Tau, got into a fireworks war with each other at 5:30 in the morning. Officers arrived and saw a person shooting fireworks out of the third floor of Phi Tau, according to Police Sergeant John Varley. Firefighters arrived to find people sleeping through the alarms, Varley said. The students wouldn't hand over the fireworks, so officers got search warrants for both houses and not only found various exploded and unexploded fireworks, but also pretty significant amounts of various drugs, including cocaine, hash, and marijuana. Okay, if these kids had any brains, and they are in university, right? They could have just handed over the fireworks when asked, and then a search warrant wouldn't have been needed, which then would not have uncovered everything else. Anyway, the university has suspended both frats, and seven students have been arrested. The fire department said that they would issue several citations. Here's a quote from the Oxford fire chief, John Detheridge. He said, "We take this safety stuff pretty seriously. We want these kids to live long enough to be able to graduate, and we're going to do whatever it takes to stop this kind of behavior." Really? You know what that quote tells me? That quote tells me, after graduation, they're on their own. Which might be a frightening thought. Anyway, a cabbie picked up a fare in Bowie, Maryland, and took him to a business area in town. Now, once arrived at the destination, the passenger demanded money in an apparent robbery attempt and struck the driver in the head and then threw some kind of liquid on him. This according to Bowie Police Chief Chuck Neske. Now, not wanting to see what would happen next, the driver dove out of the taxi. The liquid was flammable. The passenger apparently ignited it just as the driver escaped with minor burns. The robber, however, did not escape. Firefighters found his charred body in the back of the cab. You know, sometimes it really pays to think things through before you start. Either that or stop watching Roadrunner cartoons and taking them to heart. Now, while performing routine sewer line inspections, city workers in Pittsburgh, Kansas, came across some items you don't see every day in a sewer. A TV, a microwave, and a kitchen sink. Now, while the TV and microwave were easily removed, the sink is wedged into the line, and the city may have to dig up a large section of the street just to remove it. We may have to go and bring in a private contractor and dig up the sewer and go all the way down, which will be a large excavation, said the director of utilities, John Bailey. Had the items not been discovered before a heavy rain, the sewage could have backed up into homes, causing thousands of dollars of damage. As it is, the residents must absorb a $30,000 bill to install locking manhole covers to prevent an incident like this from happening again. Here's a quote I love from Bailey. He says, "You have to work at it to get a microwave in a sewer. It's pretty hard to flush it down the toilet." Well, that's the understatement of the day, don't you think? Moving right along, Keith West, age 21, was taking apart a 10-gauge shotgun shell at a shed at his home in Clark, Colorado, when the power tool he was using hit the shell's primer, setting it off. Yes, the power tool on a shell. West, who was holding the shell, went to a neighbor's for help. The neighbor apparently called 911. Deputies found the exploded shell, but they were unable to recover any of West's fingers. Any of them. "Our heart goes out to this young man and his family," said Rout County Undersheriff Ray Birch. "This is an example of the things that can happen. If a child finds something like this, they need to notify an adult." Yeah, that is correct. A child should notify an adult, but clearly not this adult in the story. Remember, Keith West is 21 years old. And now, even naked, he can't count up to his age. And, you know, that story came dangerously close, could have come dangerously close to being a Darwin File story. But no, it wasn't. But what we have for you right now is a Darwin File story, because as you know, the tree of life is often self-pruning. When a 20-year-old man and his three friends saw a children's merry-go-round in Bavaria, Germany, they knew what they had to do. The friends dared him to let them tape him to the merry-go-round and see how fast they could spin it. He agreed. After taping him down, the friends tied the merry-go-round to their car and drove off as quickly as they could. The merry-go-round spun so fast that the tape came loose and the man was flung off, sustaining head injuries and dying at the scene. The friends were all taken to the hospital to be treated for shock and now face involuntary manslaughter charges. I'm sure they'll feel better when their friend qualifies for the Darwin Award. Yeah, unbelievable. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the program, shall we? A few weeks ago, on Stuff File number 0157, we spoke to author Raymond Benson about his latest book, The Black Stiletto. But as I mentioned at the time, he was the first American to be an official author of James Bond books. Well, I thought it would be timely, what with the upcoming release of a new Bond film, the 50th anniversary of the first flick, and the release of the Bond 50 Blu-ray box set, and also Bond's spectacular arrival at the recent Olympics with the Queen, to talk about all things 007 with someone who knows him well. Raymond is on the line with us right now, once again from Illinois. Hi, Raymond.
Well, hello.
Thanks.
Good to be back. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being back on the program. So right off the bat, I got to ask you, as someone who's written basically six James Bond novels and three novelizations, how did you feel about James Bond parachuting with the Queen at the Olympics?
Well, I thought it was a hoot. It was funny. That little clip inside the palace that was apparently directed by Danny Boyle was really funny. I thought Craig handled himself well, and the Queen. I mean, she really does have a sense of humor. Yeah. So, yeah, that was great.
Now, Bond is getting a lot of coverage. Just mentioned all the things in the introduction. The new film coming out just recently. Entertainment Weekly had a cover story: 50 years of James Bond, the man, the movies, the martinis. What makes or what gives James Bond, in your estimation, such staying power?
Well, it came about during the 1960s at the right time. The ingredients were such that it was a no-brainer that it would become an archetype. See, in the 60s, everything coming out of England was cool. You know, we had the Beatles, you had Swinging London, you had all that mod stuff, and you had James Bond. And he was part of that whole package. There was also some of the allure of the Kennedy years, and then you had the Cold War stuff going on. Ian Fleming's books were, you know, they started in the early 50s, and they were very popular in England. They didn't really start to get popular in America until the early 1960s, actually 1961, really, when Kennedy, in a Life magazine article, stated that one of his 10 favorite books was From Russia with Love. So then there was an explosion, and we had this big spy boom, especially in the mid to late 60s. And it was all, you know, the catalyst was James Bond. We had The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and I Spy and Get Smart and The Avengers and Secret Agent and all that stuff. And the film people, thank goodness, kept quality control going all the way through the decades. They've patterned the films to sort of equal the decade that they're in. For instance, the Roger Moore films of the 70s, there's no doubt. I mean, you can just tell these were made for the 70s audience, you know. I think he's going to be the Sherlock Holmes of the latter half of the 20th century and beyond.
It's funny because I was just going to mention Sherlock Holmes, the fact that that's another character with such staying power. With the large entertainment engine that is the United States and Hollywood, does it surprise you that something American hasn't come along to equal a James Bond? Many have tried.
Oh, there's been lots of attempts, and they almost always end up as parodies, though, you know, because they can't equal it. There's no way you could create a character that's going to probably, you know, surpass him. The Bourne series in the early part of this decade gave him a run for his money. But then Casino Royale came back with Daniel Craig rebooting the series and reinventing the character for a new generation. And frankly, kicked Bourne in the butt.
As someone who was the first American to write James Bond books, you are obviously ingrained in the character. How do you feel about the progression of James Bond, you know, taking your work out of it, over the years and most recently with the last series of films?
Well, you got to understand the literary Bond is very different from the cinematic Bond. Ian Fleming's Bond was very cold and ruthless and humorless and just basically he called himself a blunt instrument. Whereas in the movies, they made him more sophisticated. He had a sense of humor. He knew the right wines and the foods and things like that. And that all started with Dr. No. The writers and producers realized that what humor they got from the books was really in the writing and, you know, the world around Bond. It wasn't the Bond character. So they had to put some kind of light touch to it, and they gave Bond a sense of humor, and that sort of stuck. You know, and then during the 70s, when Roger Moore got it, I think they felt that the classic thriller type of Bond film, like From Russia with Love, Goldfinger, that stuff, would not play as well because it was almost, you know, laughable, or at least they thought that. So they instead of making action thrillers, they made action comedies. And Roger Moore was perfect for that. In the late 80s, when Timothy Dalton got in, they decided to go back to try to do some serious crime thriller, you know, spy thrillers. And the two Timothy Dalton movies, I think, are very, very good. The 90s, with the video game industry and how much that was pushing Hollywood, I call the Pierce Brosnan Bond movies the video game Bonds, because they look like a video game. They you feel like you're in a video game when you're watching those movies. You know, and the reboot is Daniel Craig. They've started over, basically, and Casino Royale kind of went back to the basics.
It's interesting, as you go through the whole lineage of Bond, the one thing I find rather interesting about the character is, even though they were certainly written and produced, the films were, for their times, they do hold up well.
Most of them do, yes.
Okay, which ones would you say? I have a pick of ones that I don't think hold up. One in particular. Which ones don't you think hold up well?
Well, I'm not going to say, okay. But I will tell you what my favorites are.
Okay.
The ones that I will always go back to, and that's everyone that was made in the 60s, including Honor, Majesty, Secret Service, which I think is one of the best Bond films. That's the one starring George Lazenby.
Right.
I really like the two Dalton ones. I like GoldenEye, Tomorrow Never Dies, and I love Casino Royale, the new one.
Okay. So we've kind of left out a bomb there. You can figure that out, I guess. It's also interesting that you said that he wasn't that sophisticated in the books, and I'm going to disagree just a little bit, only because in talking with, by the way, female mystery writers, I asked a female mystery writer once, what's the difference between a male writer and a female writer? And she said, female mysteries feed their characters. Literally, feed their characters food. And the one thing I always found interesting about Bond is he knows how to eat. There's a lot about the menu, everything he eats and everywhere he goes, and more so than in most characters I've ever seen.
Yeah, that's true. The food and the drink, he's very sophisticated with. But clothing, he really didn't care about. You know, he likes his cars, but, you know, not in the way that the Bond... You know, the Bond in the movies is just so much more worldly. And, you know, Bond in the books, he's a civil servant who can do his job really well, and he's a sensual person. He certainly likes his sex, and he likes his food and drink, you know, the things that stimulate his senses. But, you know, he doesn't go to the cinema or the theater, or, you know, what he reads is usually technical manuals and spy novels. So.
We got about a minute. I just want to talk about your books. You wrote, as I said, 6 James Bond novels and 3 novelizations. And I understand that they're just coming out on the Kindle.
That's right. They have been in print in America as anthologies, the Union Trilogy and Choice of Weapons, 2 anthologies that had 3 of the books each, plus the short stories. And they're just now available as individual ebooks. So if you've got a Kindle or a Nook or any of those devices, you can get all 6 of them. 0-10, The Facts of Death, High Time to Kill, Double Shot, Never Dream of Dying, and The Man with the Red Tattoo.
And it must be, again, satisfying to know that something you've done, which is now a while ago, again, as part of the Bond canon, has such staying power.
Well, it's very gratifying. I mean, you know, John Gardner's are now all available as well. He was the guy before me. After me was Sebastian Falks and Jeffrey Deaver, and William Boyd will be doing the next Bond novel. And Kingsley Amis was the first one after Ian Fleming.
Well, people can find out more information by going on Kindle. And by the way, people can find out information about you just by going to your website, which is raymondbenson.com. And also, as we talked about the last time you were on the show, The Black Stiletto, your books that are coming out based on that character, people can check out theblackstiletto.net. And Raymond, I thank you once again for being on the program with us.
I thank you, sir, for having me.
Raymond Benson, author of several James Bond books that are now available on Kindle. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0163, and you'll find links to Raymond's sites, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his books directly, including the Kindle version of his James Bond novels.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to The Stuff File program. It's the choice of 4 out of 5 dentists. The 5th dentist also listens, but that's just because he follows the crowd. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to Jeffrey Gurian, the co-author of Make 'em Laugh, 35 years of the comic strip, the greatest comedy club of all time. And we'll also meet a Ford dealer in Alberta who has a rather interesting way in attempting to regain some of the stuff that was stolen from his lot. He did it by doing a radio commercial, and that commercial has gone viral. We'll talk about that a little later on. And, of course, there is indeed an idiot of the day coming your way. But right now, much more stuff on the Stuff File program, a show also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, The Smart Way to listen to radio. Now, while patrolling in Kenner, Louisiana, a police officer spotted Jason Ray Sr., age 21, and Chad Nicholson, age 18, driving near businesses that were closed. Now, after following them for a while, the officer pulled him over and found that the driver had no license, no registration, and no explanation for the marijuana smell wafting from the car. Again, I know I bring this up every time I have a story like this, but I just can never figure out why every time they stop someone for whatever they stop someone for, no matter what they're doing, they have no license and no registration or a suspended license. It always seems to happen. Anyway, when questioned, Nicholson allegedly told the officer, "Yeah, we smoked a little weed," according to the arrest report. He also admitted that there was some marijuana in the car, but he didn't know where it was. That's when Ray allegedly spoke up and told the officer the pot was under his seat. But when the officer checked, the pot wasn't there. Ray then allegedly said, "I hope it didn't fall out on my lap when I got out of the car by the levee. Can you go get my weed?" Yeah, he actually said, "Can you go get my weed?" Okay, so the officer located the nearly full-ounce bag of pot right where Ray said it was, by the levee. Both men were arrested. You know, there just might be a connection between what they smoked and what they said, and that's the only reason why I didn't make them the idiot of the day. Because it was pot-induced. Because, you know, people who are the idiots of the day do it with just the God-given brain power that they naturally possess. Moving right along, here's a story that I find particularly disturbing. It's one of those stories where the state likes to step in and correct a problem that doesn't really exist. Here's a quote from Tammy Cooper's daughter. "Please, please don't take my mom to jail. Please, she didn't do anything wrong." That's what her daughter said. But the police did take her mother away, orange jumpsuit, in the cell, slammed the door for 18 hours, Cooper says, and accused her of abandoning her daughter and son. Now, one of the officers told Cooper a neighbor had said that she hadn't been supervising her kids' play. The kids, who are 9 and 6, had been riding scooters around their cul-de-sac. Yes, that's French for dead end, basically, which means no through traffic, just a bunch of houses. They were riding around their cul-de-sac while Cooper was watching from their lawn, mere feet away. Charges were eventually dropped, and Cooper is suing the LaPorte, Texas Police Department, which says it stands by its officers' actions, which means, apparently, that idiocy works its way up the chain at this police department. Wow. It seems everyone had more than enough supervision, except the police in this story. Tell me, who watched the kids after they hauled their mom off to jail? That's what I want to know. Un-freaking-believable. Moving right along, a Roman Catholic priest dropped dead at the altar before a couple exchanged their vows in Germany over the weekend. Gregors Wieczorek, age 47, collapsed while he delivered a prayer at the St. Lambert Church in Bavaria. The pastor's head hit on a stone floor in front of the shocked couple and their nearly 100 guests. "It was like something out of a movie," said organist Andrea Wittmann. The Polish priest is believed to have suffered a heart attack. Many of the guests had traveled great distances to be there, so the bride and groom, from Germany and Italy respectively, decided to continue the ceremony several hours later with another priest at a different church. Wow. You know, that second priest is really tempting fate. Because, I mean, what if the passing of the first father was a sign from God that these two should not be married? But then again, the very fact that he's a priest means he's got great faith, he believes, and he's testing it right here. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a Norwegian man who had been drinking and fell asleep in the back seat of his car said he woke up to discover two car thieves had driven him to Sweden. The 50-year-old man, whose name was not released, said he fell asleep after drinking Tuesday night in Oslo and awoke to find two women unloading him from his vehicle in Gothenburg, Sweden. The man contacted police and was allowed to spend the rest of the night at a police station. He said officers were giving him a ride to the train station Wednesday when they spotted his car on the road. "I was bloody lucky," the man told a local newspaper. The two women, who police said were suspected of being intoxicated, were arrested and the man's car was returned to him. Police said they recovered what they believed to be stolen goods from the vehicle. Now, here's a guy who was both unlucky and lucky in the same night. Wow. And he's got a story to tell for the rest of his life. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Jeffrey Gurian is a very funny man. I've gotten to know him over the years because the New York-based chronicler of comedy has been coming to Montreal each year for over 20 years for the Just for Laughs Festival. Well, now he is the co-author of a new book called Make 'em Laugh, 35 Years of the Comic Strip, the Greatest Comedy Club of All Time. And Jeffrey joins us on the line right now from New York City. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hey, Peter. How are you?
Fine. Nice to have you on the program. It's always nice to talk to you.
I always love being on your show. We always have a great time, and we have for many years. We go back, man. We go way back.
Now, you do so much in comedy, and this is just the latest thing you've done. And I understand it's taken you a while to get this book off the ground. How long have you been putting this book together?
It was a four-year process, Peter. Believe it or not, I started at the Just for Laughs Festival in the summer of 2008 with my first three interviews, Larry Miller, George Wallace, and Paul Provenza. And these were people who started out at the comic strip in the earliest days. And for any of your viewers who might not know, the comic strip is a legendary comedy club in New York City that launched the careers of Jerry Seinfeld, Eddie Murphy, Chris Rock, Adam Sandler, just to name a few names that people have definitely heard of. I mean, it's such an interesting thing because it's still going strong. It opened on June 1st of 1976, and on June 17th, Jerry Seinfeld walked into audition. And his first sign-up sheet is still on the wall of the club. It's actually in the book. We took a photo of it, and it's printed. There's a whole color section in the book. And they said about Jerry that he was good and that they should definitely invite him back on Monday, June 21st, 4 days later. And that's really what kick-started his career. And he became an MC at the club, the fastest of anybody. I think within his first 3 months of performing there, he was an MC. And then he started one night, and then he got up to three nights. And that was it, man. And he was just, that was his home. He lived there. And so it's been 4 years, but I have to say that it was a labor of love. I really enjoyed every minute of it.
Okay, there are a lot of comedy clubs out there, and each city has many of them. Is this a chicken or the egg question? And by that I mean, which came first? The fact that there is the comedy strip, and it was a magnet for great comedians, or was it that great comedians found the comic strip?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question. In 76, there are only two major clubs in New York. Bud Friedman had opened the Improv in 1963, and it didn't start as a comedy club. They had music and singing and stuff, and then he started focusing really on comedy. And then in 1972, at the end of 72, Rick Newman opened Catch a Rising Star, and that was a home for people like, you know, Robert Klein and David Brenner and Billy Crystal and, you know, a lot of the stars of that next generation. And then the comic strip opened in 76 as a result of Richie Tinkin, who is the owner and founder, seeing how busy Catch a Rising Star was. One of his bartenders, it's such an interesting story how things happen. There's a very synchronistic series of events that happens in everybody's life, and sometimes you don't see it until you look back on it. There was a bartender named Tony D'Andrea, and he was an impressionist, and he was working for Richie Tinkin, who had only been a bar owner in the Bronx. He never really was in show business. He used to hire, you know, acts like bands to perform in his bar. And Tony D'Andrea was an impressionist, and he got a chance to perform at Catch a Rising Star, and it was going to be on a Monday night. That was their audition night. So he invited Richie to come down and see him perform. And Richie said, you know, in the Bronx on a Monday night, there's like three people in the whole place, so he didn't mind taking off. And he brought 14 people with him to see Tony perform. And they were drinking and having a good time, but the night kept going on and on, and Tony wasn't going on stage. So finally, Richie said, go ask Rick Newman. You know, he didn't know him then, but he said, go ask the owner when you're going to go on. And the place was packed. He said it was like five deep at the bar. So Tony went to Rick, and he said, when do I go on? I got 14 customers here to see me. And Rick said something like, you know, customers I don't need. He goes, you'll go on when you're supposed to go on. And Richie was shocked. He says he never heard a bar owner say customers I don't need, you know. So he looked into it. He started coming down every night, and he noticed that every night the place was packed. And it gave him the idea maybe he could open a comedy club too. So he and his partner started looking for a space. And one night, on their way to meet their third partner, Bob Wax, an attorney, they looked out the window of a taxi cab, and one guy said to the other, where are we going to find a space like that? And Richie Tinkin said, right over there. And it was a place called the Shannon Bar, and they jumped out of the taxi, and they went to look at this place, and that place became the comic strip.
Wow.
Isn't that a wild story? Just because they went to see Tony D'Andrea at Catch a Rising Star. So there were already comedy clubs in existence, but those two comedy clubs closed a long time ago in New York. You know, the Improv is in L.A. With Bud, and Catch a Rising Star doesn't really exist anymore, even though Rick Newman is still a powerful force in comedy. As a matter of fact, he's in this book. I interviewed him. I brought him and Richie together, and it was a great time because Richie had the opportunity to tell Rick that he was his idol and his inspiration. And I got these two guys hugging each other. I got photos of that, which was very cool. These two lions of comedy, you know?
What was Rick's reaction to that story?
He was kind of moved by it, you know? I mean, these guys, you know, they've been through so much. It wasn't like he broke down in tears, but he was very, it was an emotional moment because they're both very successful. You know, Richie discovered Eddie Murphy and managed him for like the first 11 years of his career up through Beverly Hills Cop 2. And so they've both had great success, but it was very cool to see Richie say to Rick, you know, "You were my idol, man. You inspired me." And Rick was very touched, you know, and then I got pictures of them hugging each other, which was a very cool moment because it was just the three of us in the club. I did most of the interviews at the club, you know, like Seinfeld came in and Ray Romano and Paul Reiser and Susie Essman, Colin Quinn. They all came into the club, Jim Gaffigan, you know. A couple that didn't, I flew out to L.A. to interview Billy Crystal because he was the first performer ever on stage. On the opening night, June 1st, 1976, Billy Crystal opened the club. So I thought it would be perfect to have him in the book. And, you know, Larry Miller and George Wallace I did up in Montreal. But most of them, Rick Overton, Lisa Lampanelli, Adam Ferrara, Jim Brewer, they all came into the club because I thought it would be good for them to do an interview surrounded by things that would bring back memories to them.
You're turning into the Ken Burns of comedy.
Or the James Lipton, people say. It's so funny that I'm becoming this like historian of comedy, which was never my focus really, you know, but I started doing this column. I started writing a vlog called Comedy Matters in 1999. In those days, it wasn't a vlog. It was just like a blog. I guess it was a zine, you know? And I was covering the comedy scene because it always, you know, as a comedy writer, I got to know so many comics, and I wasn't performing yet in those days. But I'd be at every show. People are like, you know, in this new sizzle reel that I just did, Mark Maron said, for the last 75 years in comedy, the only thing you could count on was Jeffrey's hair. Every place he goes, even through the dark moments in my life, Jeffrey's hair got me through. I would see you and your hair, I knew that everything would be okay.
Now I'm laughing. So, I'm laughing because I know you. People who are listening to this will have to go to your website, jeffreygurian.com, just to see the hair, so they'll know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like so many people commented on my hair about how how it meant something to them. He said, "It's an honor to speak to you and your hair," you know. And so I was covering the comedy scene for a long time. And about 2 years ago, I launched Comedy Matters TV, which is an internet channel, and it's all A-list comics, you know. It's Jimmy Fallon and Chelsea Handler and Bob Saget and, you know, Howie Mandel. And I go backstage and I kick it with these guys, and we talk about, you know, it's not a cold kind of journalistic interview. Like, you know so many comics, so when you talk to comics, too, they're comfortable with you. And it's that kind of thing, as opposed to a journalist who never met them before, who goes up to ask them, "Well, what's your next project going to be?" You know, something like that. And so, Comedy Matters TV is like really fun, and I hope your viewers will check that out as well. Your listeners, it's on YouTube, and it's like youtube.com/Gurian News Network. Okay, that I did that?
Absolutely.
Gurian. It's the Gurian, as in Nancy. Gurian News Network.
And
you'll see some really fun stuff with, like, everybody that you guys like to watch on TV.
And we'll put all the links up on our website for the show as well, so that'll be all there. People don't have to know how to spell Gurian, although you just did. We have that information up on the site. One last quick question I want to ask, and that is,
sure,
you have chronicled so many comics over the years, and you now have this book, Make 'Em Laugh, 35 Years of the Comic Strip, The Greatest Comedy Club of All Time. Looking back at what you've done with this book, is it something that is for the comedy fan, or is it actually a primer for someone who wants to get into comedy, or both?
You know what? It's really both, and that's such a good question. You're a very good interviewer, I have to tell you, because it really is for both. It's for comedy fans who want to read intimate and fun stories about their favorite stars. And it's not only the originals, but I have, you know, a chapter on the new kids, you know, in the club, who were people like Lisa Lampanelli and Jim Brewer and Tony Rock, Jeffrey Ross, Judah Friedlander, you know. Then there's like, I even talked to people who were like, I wrote it like it's a family. So there were friends of the family, like Rory Rosegarten, who handles Ray Romano, you know, and was his manager and met him at the comic strip. So his huge career started at the strip. It's a book for comedy fans. It's a book for industry people. It's a book for the comedians themselves to read, you know, like young aspiring comics who want to read how people got their start. I was always fascinated about that because as talented as you are, there's so much luck involved. Who might be in the audience that night to see you? Just the way Chris Rock got discovered by Eddie Murphy. Chris was 19 years old in 1986, and his deal was that he could get stage time by setting up chairs and tables and cleaning up the club at night. Eddie Murphy comes in one night, and he asks if there are any black comics that he can see. And believe it or not, in those days, there were hardly any black comics. So they had no choice but to put Chris up because they didn't want Eddie to leave because everyone was excited when Eddie Murphy showed up. He was the Elvis of comedy, you know? And so they put Chris up on stage. He had never been up before a full audience before. He used to perform 2 or 3 in the morning for 6 people. He went up, and it was a Friday night, and it was a packed house, and he killed. And he knew that his idol, Eddie Murphy, was there, and Eddie was waiting for him when he got off stage, gave him his phone number, and that's what started Chris's career, and he put him in Beverly Hills Cop 2, which really made him.
Excellent.
So it's the kind of book that has stories that people have never heard before told by the stars themselves, and I found it very exciting to do, and I wound up being like the historian of the club, which is interesting to me.
The book is called Make 'Em Laugh, 35 Years of the Comic Strip, the Greatest Comedy Club of All Time. Jeffrey, I thank you very much for being on the program.
It's always an honor to talk to you, Peter. Thanks so much for having me on.
Jeffrey Gurian, co-author of Make 'Em Laugh, 35 Years of the Comic Strip, the Greatest Comedy Club of All Time. You can check out his website at jeffreygurian.com. You can also go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0163. And you'll find links to Jeffrey's various sites mentioned, including his YouTube site. You'll also find links to amazon.com and amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. As the campaign season swings into high gear, it often seems like politicians can't agree on anything. But I'd like to tell you about a time when two former presidential candidates who were on totally opposite ends of the political spectrum came together to make a very special TV ad. It featured the liberal former U.S. Senator George McGovern and the conservative former Congressman Jack Kemp. The ad began with the two men sitting side by side and acknowledging that they didn't often agree on political issues. Talk about an understatement. But then McGovern, once the leader of the Democratic Party, looked into the camera and said that they did agree on one thing, the dangers of lawsuit abuse. You see, after he retired from politics, McGovern bought a small country inn, and unfortunately, frivolous lawsuits eventually helped close it down. Let's be fair, the more people learn about the harm done by lawsuit abuse, the more they agree that it hurts everyone. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
From Montreal, Canada, and spanning the globe like a butterfly on speed, this is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll have an idiot of the day. Plus, we'll meet Marty Giles, who is a Ford dealer from Alberta with an interesting story about theft. But first, one more Stuff File story to get to before we wrap things up on the program. We go to Russia for our next story. Police in Russia say a man accused of stealing 1.5 tons of hay allegedly took the haul from a neighbor's field as a makeup gift to his girlfriend. Investigators say the man allegedly loaded the hay onto his truck after fighting with his girlfriend and took the pilfered hay to her home in the hopes of obtaining forgiveness. There are just too many bad jokes to write about this one, but I really would like to know what the thought process was in this guy's head. I mean, hey, buddy, flowers, perhaps chocolates, maybe perfume, but 1.5 tons of hay? Really? Really? Anyway, Speaking of interesting thefts, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program. A Ford dealer in Alberta, Canada, who was a victim of theft on his dealership's lot, has decided to fight back in a unique way. He's airing a radio commercial that offers a $10,000 reward for info on the stolen tires and rims. Here is that radio ad.
Marty Giles here for North Star Ford, and I know you've heard about our family pricing initiative. Over the weekend, however, North Star Ford had some non-family members come steal some rims and tires off a new Hardy truck, a new Mustang, and a new F-150 FX4. Instead of getting mad about it, I thought I would turn it into a positive, as that is what we do at North Star Ford, and we try and help the community. If you give us a tip or the RCMP a tip that leads to the recovery of these tires and rims and arrest of these criminals, we will give you $10,000. We will also give $10,000 to a Wood Buffalo charity of the RCMP's choosing. Now, if these criminals return these rims and tires, I will call off the posse, no harm, no foul. You think one of your pals won't turn you in for 10 grand? Better return those, Skippy, as I get a great deal on commercials and I'll run them forever until you get caught. Was your friend really on his cell phone right now talking to his sister? Or maybe he was calling us to turn you in. You can't be too sure. Come on, Wood Buffalo. Let's get together and catch these criminals and raise money for a good cause. You and a charity in Wood Buffalo get to win. $10,000 upon the arrest, and $10,000 will go to the community for a great cause that the RCMP chooses. North Star Ford, the way the ratting out your friend experience should be.
Now, that ad you just heard has garnered a lot of attention and has gone viral on YouTube. And on the line with us right now is Marty Giles from North Star Ford in Fort McMurray, Alberta. Hi, Marty.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us. So I'm going on the assumption, I mean, you've been a dealer for a while, correct?
Yeah, since 1995.
Okay, so I'm going on the assumption that it's not the first time you might have had any trouble with a dealership. Unfortunately, that's just part of the business. People will either vandalize or steal.
Absolutely, yes. In fact, we got some rims stolen back in April, and we just did nothing about it, and then when these rims got stolen again in June, 2 months later, that's what triggered us to do these ads.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask. At what point did you say, okay, that's enough, I've got to do something different here?
About 3 seconds after I found out they got stolen.
Wow, okay.
Pretty fired up.
Now, so you create these ads. I'm sure you have a regular series of radio ads you're running in your market. Was there any question or cause of concern from the radio station in question saying, I don't know if we should air that, Marty?
No, they were. They thought it was hilarious and loved it, and they have no problem at all with that. So
excellent. So the initial idea was to get response from people within the area to maybe come forward and basically rat out the people who stole from you. Have you received any response? What's the latest now with the stolen rims?
Okay, I'll try and answer that. So first of all, the initial idea was, it's not that someone would turn someone in, but I'd create doubt in the thief's mind. It's like, I wrote these ads in about 8 minutes. I phoned the radio station down. I was down there like an hour and a half after I wrote them, I guess. And they were probably on the radio, I think, that same day, right? So my thought was is that if they heard it, the thieves would then actually be scared enough and maybe paranoid enough with their friends or whatever that they would bring them back within a day or two, and they'd just show up on my doorstep one morning, right? That was the actual original idea behind it, which didn't work.
That didn't work. So then what about the response? What response was, what was the response like locally in your area?
Lots. Lots of people sent in all kinds of different things they saw on different classified ads like Kijiji and different things like that. But the ones we looked into, they were all the wrong model year rims and tires. And in hindsight, chances it was probably not the smartest thing to run them in Fort McMurray, because these thieves probably took them. They're probably out of town 10 minutes after they were off the vehicles and headed somewhere in Western Canada to be sold in the big city, probably, because it's just too small a town to list five brand new sets of rims and tires.
Gotcha. Now, beyond Fort McMurray, you got a response, as I mentioned in the introduction. This thing has gone viral. Are you surprised by the attention that you're receiving?
Absolutely. Especially because we did it in June, and it was huge response around our community. I was like, way to go. Thanks for sticking up for Fort McMurray. It's awesome. I hope you catch those guys, the whole bit, right? And then for about a week or 10 days, then it kind of died out, or people got used to us running it. And then about like 12 days ago, one of my sales guys came in and he saw it on some blog. And then we got a call out of Phoenix, which was a TV station down there that did a story on it. And then all of a sudden, we had like 4,000 YouTube hits. Then it went to 12,000, and it's like now I think it's almost 60,000 YouTube hits right now on the ad. And it's not even any video, it's just a radio ad, right? So, yeah, I can't believe it. What it's done in the last 12 days is unbelievable.
Now, are you anticipating the possibility that you might still get those rims? Because, you know, with this thing going viral, let's be honest, thieves aren't too bright. One of them is going to say to a buddy, yeah, I'm the guy who did that.
Yeah, I think we're going to get them, man. I really do. I think it's going to get out there. It's a lot of money for the person who turns them in. We've actually had one young girl call me and said, listen, if I help find them, can I just give my whole $20,000 to charity and not take anything? So we actually have a little army of people out there trying to find it right now. So I really like our chances now, especially since because it's went viral and it's gone all over the country and even parts of North America, right?
And that's an interesting point, by the way. You mentioned, I neglected to mention in the introduction, I mentioned the reward, but that's for charity, right?
Well, so what the reward's down to is it's $10,000 goes to charity and $10,000 goes to the informant, so a total of $20,000. And so people have asked, some of the other people have interviewed me, why did you pick that number? Well, going back again to why we were trying to run the ad, I figured that the person who took them might get scared and turn them in. So I was at that moment when I found they were gone, I was out $20,000. So there's nothing I could do about that. But if I got the rims and tires back, at least I get them back on the cars. I don't have to wait to order them and all that stuff. And then the $20,000 can go to a good cause. I guess $10,000 to the informant, I guess, and $10,000 to the charity. So that was the original intention. That's why we picked that dollar amount, because that was the value of the goods.
Now, you know, there are people out there who are very, very cynical. So I have to ask the question. This wasn't all done just as a publicity stunt, right? Was it? You really did want to get your rims back.
Absolutely. No, believe me, I would. Now, am I happy with the result? I'd be lying if I said I'm not, because I mean, the amount of publicity we're getting around it, it's been, but definitely at the time, I was just really, really choked. And I thought I could get them back, and it was not a publicity stunt. I do not have the rims, just so you know, in my basement.
Okay. And working your way up the chain, what are the folks at Ford saying up the chain? Did you have to clear this with anybody, or you just went out and did this on your own? And is there any reaction from head office?
Head office loves it. That Ford has always been a supporter of the community that they do business in. They believe in the charity aspect. They're really behind it, and they're loving that we're doing it, right? And I didn't clear it with them. I sort of have a little bit of a ready, fire, aim mentality. And that sometimes gets me in trouble, but they were like, right from the president herself, actually, Diane Craig, she sent me a note and says, you go get them. I hope you get them, and let us know if you do, so.
Well, I'm sure that whoever stole them, first of all, do you think the people who stole them, do you think they're local?
No, I don't. I don't know if all thieves are dumb, like you said earlier. I think these guys were sharp. They came in the way they did it. This wasn't their first rodeo, so to speak. So I think that, again, they took them out and took them somewhere else to sell them anywhere but Fort McMurray, because, again, it's a pretty small world up there, right?
What have the folks at the RCMP said about this?
They were very supportive as well. They said that it's great. We haven't obviously caught them yet, but any help they can get, they appreciated it.
Well, I hope you do catch the folks who did this, and you certainly have found a unique way. I guess, as the saying goes, you've made lemonade out of lemons here.
Well, we'll see. The biggest thing is I do have the ads in my head written for when we catch them. I can't wait to actually be able to do that. So we won't know if I've made lemonade yet, because we actually haven't done anything as far as catching them. That'll really be sweet, though. You know, imagine, get the money, the charity gets the money, the informant gets the money, we get the publicity, we get our rims and tires back. This guy or girl, I shouldn't just say, could have been a female, I guess, then gets their just punishment. And maybe what they can do is next time we'll give them such a good deal that they can come right in daytime and get it and buy a vehicle and not have to worry about stealing part of one.
Good idea. Well, good luck with this. I hope it all works out for you, Marty. I thank you very, very much for taking the time to talk with us.
All right, Peter, I really appreciate the time. And again, if you're out there, the RCMP detachment in Fort McMurray, give them a shout. If you have any inkling that you might know someone out there, we'd really appreciate it to any of your listeners if they could help us catch these buggers.
Marty Giles from North Star Ford in Fort McMurray, Alberta. You can check out their website. You'll find the link on my website at thestufffile.com. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
A news agent in Oxfordshire, England, was robbed twice in 10 days. In the second instance, the robber pulled off his balaclava before he left the store, allowing staff to both recognize him as a regular customer and allowing security cameras to get a clear shot of his face. Things went further downhill for the suspect, James Allen, age 28, from there. When he got to the exit, it wouldn't open. He pushed when the door said pull. He was a regular customer, right? Yeah, anyway. The manager, knowing who he was, let him out, and police picked him up several hours later for both robberies. Now, clearly, his life's ambition is to someday rise to the level of stupid, because why would somebody remove their mask during a robbery at a place where he's a regular customer? One reason, and one reason only, he's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0163. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0163. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Void where prohibited, offer slightly different in Canada. For a complete transcript of this program, next time write down everything Peter says.